content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Anna Dean Silver from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Out in the Garden. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the book by Margaret Roach, A Way to Garden, a hands-on primer for every season. And we'll begin today's session with, again, the chapter on birth, which is March and April. And we start with planting peas with Mendel in mind. Since I first cultivated a vegetable garden, planting peas has been the task that marked its start. One recent March, I approached the welcome ritual with new reverence for the genetics built into a single pisum sativum seed, and with a diversity of varieties to sow. It was 2013, and I had just audited an online class at MIT called Introduction to Biology, The Secret of Life. The professor, Eric Lander, one of the principal leaders of the Human Genome Project, had been teaching it for 20 years, almost as long as I'd been planting peas. It was the first time he taught it simultaneously online. So besides the classroom full of MIT undergraduates, there were thousands of us unseen virtual types learning about subjects that, to my delight, included Gregor Mendel and his early genetic experiments with peas. It turns out that Mendel started his scrupulous research by simply going down to the market in Brno in the Moravian region of today's Czech Republic and buying 34 varieties of peas from several seedmen. Knowing this makes me less self-conscious that I ordered at least 10 kinds. It was no accident that he chose peas as his subject. They didn't take up much space in the monastery garden confines, and the structure of a pea flower that is with its enclosed fertilizing organs makes random cross-pollination unlikely. Mendel carefully set up his controls, then bred the 34 to see if they transmitted their traits faithfully. That took 2 years and resulted in 22 making the cut for the actual experiments that followed. The ones about wrinkled and smooth seeds and short and tall plants that most of us studied in secondary school science. Not long after the Mendel lecture, thanks to a few sunny days, it was time for pea planting in my non-virtual life. I cultivated the soil along the edge of two raised beds, choosing the side that won't cast shade when the peas are trellised and tender, and render the rest of the space useless. In a generous furrow, a couple of inches deep made with a hoe, I sprinkled legume inoculant very lightly. Sometimes I instead moisten the seeds lightly in a bowl and sprinkle the powder or granules onto them, mixing with a spoon. I sowed double thick rows, a few inches across and an inch or so between seeds in all directions. I don't get all precise about it, Years ago, I'd make a perfect grid of two staggered rows in the cultivated soil with my dibber, poking 1.5-inch deep holes every inch or two apart, dropping in one seed per hole. Although I was once more measured and controlled, I've lately become a scatterer. The peas cooperate either way. I raked the dislodged soil back into place, tamped it down so the seeds are covered about 1.5 inches deep, and then prayed the chipmunks didn't notice what treasure I buried. I usually pin down remay or burlap on the soil surface until the peas are well up. Then keeping woodchucks or rabbits at bay later became my primary animal control assignment. I sat on the edge of that bed in the strengthening March sunshine, reading each packet while marking the labels needed to complete the job. Some promised tall vines, some short ones that required no staking and will yield a little sooner. Some will have purple flowers, other white or even pink. I'd just sown seeds that were yellowish or some green, and one cherished variety, Schweizer Ryzen, Swiss Giant, is a distant rosy green. Mendel would have noted every detail, as had the modern-day breeders who created the ones I was growing. A few of my choices are always for shelling, like Tall Telephone, also called Alderman, or Green Arrow, which I freeze for off-season eating. Another couple are snow pea types with flat edible pods, and a couple are snap peas with plump edible pods. Mendel, even with 34 kinds, would not have had those, a discovery that came about 100 years after his time. Calvin Lamborn of Gallatin Valley Seed, a sharp-eyed breeder, not in Moravia, but in Idaho, crossed a tight-potted rogue pea with a snow pea, eventually leading to Sugar Snap. Lamborn's 1979 All-American Selection Medal winner. Lamborn made People magazine that year. I always grow his Sugar Snap and his later shorter stature Sugar Ann, plus the Swiss heirloom Schweizer Riesen with the purple flowers, which shapes up like snow pea meets snap pea. For this type, you let the extra large pods puff up and fill with peas before eating. Delana Capular of Peace Seedlings in Oregon, daughter of the longtime seed and pea breeder Alan Capular, calls peas like that puffer pods, and indeed they are. Her father's star puffer pod is called Green Beauty, which was in my stash that day too. Inspired by Mendel to widen my genetic palette, I included various other capular offerings, including a purple-potted snap pea called Sugar Magnolia and a yellow-potted one called Opal Creek. I'd chosen the pink and purple flowered peas, not just the usual white, because of Delana's promise that hummingbirds would like them as much as I. In 60-something days, the first of my peas flowers and start to produce, and bring a few weeks of precious harvest if I dutifully pick daily to keep the vines productive. A girl cannot have enough peas in any year, so I get a good crop about in fall from a second sowing made in July, along with Mendel in mind. Sounds good. I think I'm going to try peas this next year, too. And the next topic is hydrangea pruning. Any garden writer's top question year after year is probably about hydrangeas and when to prune them, particularly the big leaf type or hydrangea macrophylla, an Asian species that produces mop head or lace cap blooms in blue or sometimes pink if your soil is more alkaline than acid. Gardeners commonly speak of frustration at a lack of flowers and wonder what they're doing. Before the introduction in 2005 of so-called overblooming versions, starting with the variety Endless Summer, the answer was usually considered pretty straightforward. Conventional wisdom, at least in the north, said that because hydrangea macrophylla generally bloomed on the previous year's growth, after carrying the coming year's flower buds over the winter on it, no flowers come summer usually meant someone had either pruned them off with untimely cuts in spring or late fall, or nature had killed the buds with late frost or extra deep winter freeze. Once I would have pretty confidently said to prune them just after flowering in late summer, but removing some of the weaker, older stems that have flowered right to the ground and also any younger ones that are badly positioned, crossing inward or weak, this makes room for the best positioned, stronger new growth to develop, carrying with it the promise of future flowers. In early spring, you might have some cleanup, either from damage or if last year's flowers needed deadheading or the removal of spent flowers. By now, there are seemingly endless ones. To bloom repeatedly over a longer season, they must form flower buds on both old wood and new. With these, I'd only prune if needed, cutting back each stem with spent flowers to a strong pair of buds and cleaning out any damaged or badly positioned wood in early spring. If both old and newer wood had the potential to contribute flowers, I'd decide where to make my cut based on creating a pleasing overall structure. These most beloved hydrangeas are technically hardy to zone 6-ish, and though I am right on the cusp, the same varieties are labeled for zone 5. I don't bother with them. My windswept site puts the flower beds at risk no matter how deftly I prune or preen, and besides, I'm not really a blue person except when it comes to sweet spring natives like Virginia bluebells, Mertensia virginica, or various Amsonias. If I were desperate for one of the more delicate flowered lace cap or variegated foliage types, or better yet, one of the choice hydrangeas such as Hydrangea serrata, I'd attempt to grow it in a big pot and carry it over in suspended animation in the unheated barn, simulating a winter or a slightly milder kind, not to prevent freezing, but to freeze without the combined evil forces of wind or ice or alternating sun and temperature drops. I don't lament the iffy nature of the hydrangea macrophylla types, but grow the rest of the available hydrangeas for my zone as the backbone of summer through latest fall. The other common species, H. paniculata, another Asian, is just the opposite kind of creature. It flowers on new wood, so it can be pruned as hard as you like from earliest spring until it begins to push new growth. It can be trained to a single trunk, like a small tree, and in this form has long been a classic in the Northeast in front yards of older homes as H. paniculata grandiflora, commonly called the PG. In high summer, giant cone-shaped, white-tinged, greenish flower heads begin to expand, and toward fall coloring up to a fleshy, old-fashioned pink, like grandma's powder puff, and on to tan if left to meet the frost. The straight species that PG was selected from, plain old hydrangea paniculata, is large-flowered too, but not quite so overblown. The way that the lace-cap hydrangeas are daintier than mop heads, plain H. paniculata is more refined than grandiflora. These airier trusses actually combine two kinds of blooms. The larger, showy males, which are sterile bracts and therefore of less value to pollinators and other hungry insects, and the tiny, tight female flowers that look like buds. I like these boy-girl ones best of all, and plain old beautiful H. paniculata has a place of prominence beside my front walk. Another similar selection, tardiva, is in a few spots here. I also am inclined towards ones like those of bigger stature that can grow into shrubs of 10 or even 15 feet and almost as wide. Sometimes I just go stand by one of the giant ones in my far borders at flowering time and listen and watch, since though non-native, they are loaded with pollinators and other happy insects. Lately, numerous little mounded forms of panicle hydrangea to just 3 or 5 feet high are more in vogue, such as Bobo or Little Lime. But I like mine big to suit the garden scale, and I prune them only lightly, more like deadheading plus a little bit to encourage maximum size. The recent explosion in breeding of the panicle hydrangea seems a little crazy. Who can keep track? I think there are close to 100 varieties, or at least the last time I checked, there were already 80 or 90. Even if you have multiples of the same variety, you may notice a difference in size of the flower heads depending on how each plant was pruned. If the plant's a twiggy thicket with less pruning, it will make many smaller blooms. to encourage fewer but larger panicles, reduce the number of primary shoots emanating from the trunk. I also grow hydrangea quercifolia, the southern native oak leaf hydrangea. Its large white flowers are produced on old wood, so its buds are potentially vulnerable to my winter. I have a couple that have shaped up well in protected spots, and I mostly don't prune the irregular loose plants with their peeling bark like a cinnamon stick and leaves that turn a great red, purple, bronze in fall. They bloom well in summer, even in shade. As easy here as hydrangea paniculata is, H. arborescens Annabelle, a cultivar of an eastern U.S. native, with giant summertime white snowballs that fade to greenish and look good for months. It can be cut down as far as you like to the ground, like a herbaceous perennial, or just cleaned up of any wintertime damage and thinned of some oldest stems to be more than waist high. It will flower either way, but take note. The mophead Annabelle, like the overblown paniculatus, is loaded with sterile male brackets and of little pollinator value, offering very little nectar. The straight species, by comparison, is a great habitat garden plant. The other hydrangea I have grown is the climbing ones from Asia, Hydrangea anopheles subspecies petilaris, which takes time to settle in and then becomes a large feature trained up a building or big old tree or over a wall. It can reach 60 feet unchecked with white summertime flowers that look like the lace caps. Prune to keep it in bounds just after flowering in the summer. And our next topic is my gold foliage issue. And we probably won't have time to do all of it, or maybe we will. But if not, please join our next podcast for it, for the rest. And this topic is my gold foliage issue. When I try to defend why I use so much gold foliage, maybe an excess, admittedly yet another impulse run amok, my head fills with soulful but divergent voices from the Isley brothers to Robert Frost, who would seem to have nothing to do with the matter or each other. "Nature's first green is gold," Frost wrote of the freshest fleeting color of unfolding spring. In Nothing Gold Can Stay, which is not just the poem's title, but also its last line, "Make it persist by adding other golds and chartreuses into your designs. Perhaps you don't wish to end up collecting gold leaf plants. But here is what gleaming subjects used in key spots can do for a design. They scream, a good thing if you want to draw your eye across the garden to an intended local focal point, the punctuation to an axial view, and say, come here, a big gold shrub or group of them will do that. And I suggest using others here and there along the way as well to provide content. and they brighten, a good thing in the semi-shade where you want more light. Something white variegation does even more. However, most gold leaf plants sited in too much shade will be more yellow gold, yellow green than gold. Given too much sun, they may burn. So Eric's experimentation is required. Get out the shovel if you get it wrong at first. They make things feel fresh. Even after spring fades, some gold plants, including the nine bark of Physocarpus opulifolius, darts gold, and the spike winter hazel, Acaryllopis spicata, or aurea, fade considerably to greenish yellow after their spring peak, but are still plenty worthy. They provide needed contrast to deeper colors. Think of the role the gold parts play in leaves of some favorite coleus choices. Where would the other colors be without it to offset them? Of my many gold leaf plants, I cannot imagine without certain ones, including longtime companion Hakoniclohea macra, or all gold, the yellow version of Japanese forest grass. Aurelia cordata, sun king, is a big, lusty perennial that can reach 6 by 6 feet and really makes a statement. The spreading yew, Taxus baccata, repandens aurea, is only gold in the growing season. But wow, the gold hinoki cypress, or Chamaecyparis obtusa, or Cripsea, is gold all year. And though that one gets to 25 feet, don't believe listings that say 10 feet. There are dwarf forms like golden fern and Nana lutea. And among Japanese maples, who could live without the ones referred to as full moon and autumn moon? Truth be told, I make no apologies for this or any of my other design decisions. And that's where the Isley brothers come in, circa 1969. It's your thing. Do what you want to do. I can't tell you who to sock it to. That's a good song. And we've come to the end of this broadcast. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Out in the Garden. Be sure to listen next time, and we hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Anadine Silver, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Out in the Garden is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. And we hope you will join us again at our next Out in the Garden 8.